This is an interview with Chester Grundy. The interviewer is Betsy Brinson, and it's taking place in Chester's office at the University of Kentucky. Okay, well, thank you for meeting with me today, Chester. Is it all right if I call you Chester?
Oh, please, yeah.
Okay. As you know, I've been interviewing Anne, your wife, and we're interviewing women in the first part of this project, but I thought since I've been doing such extensive interviewing with her that it would be helpful for me to talk with you a little bit. And as I shared on the phone, I want to do a little bit with you, but then I also want to ask you some questions about Anne.
Okay.
Is that
sure.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why don't we begin, Chester? Tell me a little bit about where and when you were born, your early family life, your growing up.
Mm, okay. Well, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Louisville, in an area that Louisvillians know as California. And I don't know the origin of that name, but it's now one of the historic African-American neighborhoods in the west end of Louisville. And my formative years were there. I grew up and was there until about age 12.
And you were born in what year?
1947.
Okay.
My education was in the public schools of Louisville. I went to elementary school at Phyllis Wheatley Elementary, mm-hmm. which was only two blocks from where I lived. Mm-hmm. And my teachers were people who knew my family well. I finished, well, what we call junior high school is now called middle school, at Duval Junior High School, and went on to Male High School in Louisville.
Male
High School, yeah.
All men?
At one point in its history, it was all male.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. But by the time I got there, it was co-ed. And we were, I guess, the third or fourth wave of black students to attend Male. So it was still in this process of desegregation.
Oh, so it was an integrated school by the time
it was,
you got
yeah.
there?
Okay. I guess
but
the
you've been to an all black school.
Oh yeah,
previously.
Up until that time, from the beginning of school up until the ninth grade, I had only had contact with black students and black teachers. So Male was my first contact in a desegregated setting.
Is Male spelled M-A-L-E?
M-A-L-E.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I graduated from Male in 1965.
Okay. Do you have any brothers and sisters?
One of each. I have an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay. And what about your family origins? Are they in Kentucky originally?
Yes, my father's family from Kentucky. They come from Mount Sterling, Sonora, Kentucky. Some, I think, are from Mount Washington, and some from Springfield. My mother's people from Tennessee, a little place called Linville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I've only been through there a few times. But basically, most of my family is from Kentucky and, like I said, the Tennessee area.
Okay. How did your family make their living while you were growing up?
Of my father's family, all were laborers. Mm-hmm. My father had a number of jobs, but from the time I was aware till the time he died, he was a he was connected with a car dealership, and he, at one point, did custodial work. Mm-hmm. Then he was promoted to a truck driver for the parts department. But he took a lot of side jobs. He was real resourceful. So he did what they called at that time trades. So he did TV repair. One time he raised rabbits. At one time, he would do custodial work. You know, he was pretty. He was had a real provider spirit about him. So he would do just about anything. He'd worked as assistant to funeral homes. Mm-hmm. Anything. Just a wide range of jobs. But, you know, he was a man who didn't finish high school. He had one brother who did finish high school and went out of college, but of the four of them, only one earned a degree. And the other three were just family men, laborers.
How about your mother? Did she work outside the home?
No, she was a hairdresser.
She was a hairdresser?
Right, and she, at one point in her life, she did have a shop during World War II in that period. But later on, started, as she said, fixing heads at our house. So she would do that in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And had a regular clientele that would come to the house.
Okay.
But the housewife, for the most part.
Okay. In your growing up, were you part of a church?
My father was Catholic, so we were raised in the Catholic Church. Never went to Catholic school. Mm-hmm. He resisted that. But
how did he get to be Catholic? That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, my grandfather was a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was a Protestant, but I think she just conceded to, the Catholics at one time had this policy where if you were Catholic, you had to and you wanted to be married in the Catholic Church, and all, you had to commit to raising your children as Catholics.
Don't they still have that?
Do they? I don't know. I've left the church.
Well, my daughter, who's not Catholic, is married to a Catholic, and I think that's the understanding there.
Yeah.
That the children get raised Catholic.
Yeah, well, that was the deal with us. So the three of us were brought up in the Catholic Church, went through catechism and communion and all. And I remained with the church until went to college.
Where were you in terms of, are you first, second, or third child?
I'm middle child.
You're the middle child. Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it your sister that's the oldest?
Yes.
Okay. And your brother the youngest?
Right.
Okay. How much of a age difference is there between
you? I'm 6 years older than him, and she's about 15 months older than me.
Okay. So when you graduated from high school, what happened then for you?
Well, I came here. I came to the University of Kentucky.
Okay.
And at that time, my sister was at Eastern Kentucky. So there was a period where we were both in school. My father was doing all he could to keep us here.
Mm-hmm. Two of you coming to college, and it sounds like, of your parents at least, you were the first members of the immediate family to attend college.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, my sister was a year ahead of me.
Was a year ahead of you.
Right, so she was at Eastern a year prior to my graduation.
How did it come that you chose the University of Kentucky?
Well, I must say I was pretty naive at the time in terms of knowing anything about University of Kentucky vis-a-vis its reputation with black Kentuckians, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know anything about that. But at that time, I recall I wanted to go to a large school. And I wanted to go to IU.
Indiana right. University.
Mm-hmm. But my father couldn't afford out-of-state mm-hmm. fees, so this was my next choice. And I think the fact that they had an ROTC program appealed to me, too, because I'd done that all through high school. Mm-hmm. And I had aspirations of being a career military man. Mm-hmm. So UK being large and being at least 100 miles from my sister was appealing, too. So.
So was it your sister you were interested in being further away from your parents?
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. Excuse me.
So you came here in 1965?
Right.
Okay. And what did you study?
Sociology.
Okay. And why did you choose sociology as a major?
I think it had to do with I was not clear on a major when I came here, but one of the people that I met early on was a fellow who was probably the first intellectual I ever met in my life. This guy named Major Jones, who was a Korean War vet, and he was older than most of us. But I met him in the student center. Black students would gather in student center at noontime. And this guy just struck me, really impressed me with his maturity and his insight. And he was studying sociology. So I was convinced that that's for me, you know. If he could do that for him, maybe he'll do that for me.
For you.
But he was, somebody kind of took me under his wing, and he saw I was curious about things. So, you know, he would spend time talking about the affairs of the world. Just had a point of view on things that was just kind of opened my head to some things.
Well, now, let me make sure, was he a returning student from Korea?
Yeah.
He was a student, not a faculty.
Right, a student, okay. Graduate student.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you came here, Chester, how many other black students were there here at this point in time?
50.
50 out of a total of?
16,000.
16,000. Mm-hmm. Wow. And you had been in an integrated high school.
Right.
So you had some experience of what that would be like.
Yes.
But how did you find coming here with that kind of disparity of numbers?
You know, I say I was naive. I really thought that this would only be, you know, an extension of my experience at Mill High. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we found out very quickly that it was going to be very different and that race was going to be an issue every day of our lives. Mm-hmm. So, the thing that I had to come to grips with was if I was going to stay here and survive, I was going to have to find a way to cope, being black and being in the UK. And you know, all of us were kind of struggling with that. I think we dealt with it in different ways. But, it was clear to me that I was going to have to be reminded that I was black every day of my experience here. For some people, even people that I came here with, it really took a toll. There are some people who I know are dealing with it to this day, their experience at UK in 1965. But, you know, I think I was fortunate in that I did meet some people who, you know, I saw as kind of like part of my support system. It's got Major Jones as one. And then there was there were a group of guys from Eastern Kentucky. And there were some other people in the community who I really connected with immediately. And we found out that, you know, as long as we bonded around that experience of being black and being at UK, that, you know, maybe we could do something about it. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, for me, it was like my kind of coming to awareness about who I was as a black student.
I understand that you were involved in the early days of the Black Student Union.
Right.
Here. Can you talk? That's about all I know. Can you talk
about
that
well,
for me?
Initially, there was no Black Student Union, but we did have a group that we called Orgina. And, I mean, it says everything about where we were in terms of our sense of identity, because this organization, Orgina, was primarily a social organization. It was just there to give us a social outlet. And the name itself is a Negro spelled backwards. Okay, so, and when we talk about it now, it's like we were a bunch of backwards Negroes, but you know, that's what we had and that's where we were in our thinking. So that we relied on that for a couple of years, you know, to give us, you know, some kind of opportunity to have some parties and socialize a bit, and we would have any reason to get together, you know.
So when you first came here, the Black Student Union wasn't in existence?
No, that happened about 1968. And the development of that really did parallel the events around Dr. King's assassination. So with, and then there was, you know, I mean, the Black Student Union movement across the country was really picking up momentum. So we were very much in tune with that. I mean, we had people on campus who were doing some traveling and moving around other campuses. And they would bring us back, you know, kind of information about what was happening in other places and what we ought to consider doing.
Do you remember at that point, Chester, what other campuses in Kentucky had Black Student Unions?
University of Louisville.
Okay.
In fact, we use University of Louisville as almost a reference point for us.
Okay. And Berea.
Yeah, Berea did too. But you know, we didn't have as much contact with Berea as Louisville.
Right.
We were up and down I-64
a public.
Right, public school.
A private.
Yeah, and those of us from Louisville knew students at Louisville. So it was for the next few seconds.
So when the Black Student Union started here in 68, do you remember what some of the program issues, the concerns were of the club?
Mm-hmm. You know, recently we did a panel, African American Studies and Research sponsored a panel that was kind of a retrospective of that period. And, you know, it wasn't until the four of us sat down and started talking about that period that it occurred to all of us that we were really pretty forward thinking. I don't know what what our source of inspiration was, except we didn't know what was happening around the country. But we were dealing with things, Betsy, like, well, recruitment and retention. I mean, there was our own situation that certainly a problem, but we knew, too, that if we were going to improve things, that we had to have more of us here. So we were, as students, developing recruiting programs. We would go around to local high schools and visit with high school seniors, talk with them about what it would take to prepare for UK as best we could, you know. We talked with, at the same time we were trying to put programs in place on this campus to recruit some of these students here for kind of a summer preparatory experience. And this stuff was like, you know, I won't tell my assistant to hold his car.
So you were saying that you all were going around to high schools and talking about recruitment, retention.
Right. Mm-hmm. We were lobbying for hiring of more black faculty. And we were lobbying for creation of courses. I mean, we were, back in that period, pushing for either a black history course or a black culture course. And you know, it was very interesting reviewing some of these old kernels. We were pushing this black history course, and the chair of the history department responded to us by saying that that would be much too narrow. That would be like asking for a women's history course.
Right.
You know, it's just, I mean, seeing that now, mm-hmm. it's just amazing.
And it doesn't feel like that much time.
No, it really doesn't.
By. Yeah.
But it's Dr. Cone, you know, he has it in print. Like a women's history course. I mean, you know, come on.
I can't relate to that.
So we were lobbying for that. And, you know, as things intensified around the country, we stepped up our agenda so that some of this stuff became non-negotiable. Oh, but let me tell you, too, that in this transition from Orgina to BSU was not without some conflict, internal conflict in the group, because there were a number of students who really thought that we didn't have to take on this political agenda, that it was really, you know, risky. And that if we would just work, you know, within the system and work with people who were sympathetic, that things would change. But
was it risky?
Being in the BSU, yes, yeah. I mean, the environment at that time was really, I mean, I tell people it varied from indifferent to hostile, you know? So for us to pull a cover on all these issues was not popular at all. I mean, there were a handful of administrators and a few faculty people who were sympathetic, but for the most part, I mean, it was seen as a troublesome kind of presence, you know?
I guess you felt strongly enough about it, though, if you let yourself get elected vice president of the BSU.
Oh, yeah.
And that probably made you even more visible as an officer of the organization.
Right, right. But it was, the thing that I recall about that period is, like, we knew, even though we were small in number, that we really weren't alone, that, you know, the campuses at that time were fairly, I mean, there's a lot of influences coming through here. So we got a chance to meet students from other places. We met people from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We had a guy from the SNCC who was in the graduate school here, who was kind of our liaison. We met people like Fannie Lou Hamer, who told us we were doing the right thing. We met all kinds of people. The Deacons of Defense from Bogalusa, Louisiana came through, You know, it was like a full run through Black Panther Party. So it was, you know, I mean, it's heady times, and we were just ready for it. And
did the school sponsor any of those people to come to campus to talk?
No. You know, I recall that there was no, at that time, there was no programming unit, mm-hmm. you know. The student center would sponsor some social, cultural things, but not on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Generally, when speakers came, they came under the sponsorship of, we had a human relations club at that time. There were, I think SDS had a chapter here.
Mm-hmm. How about NSA, National Student Association?
I think so. I don't really recall, but there were two or three mm-hmm. kind of progressive radical groups here. And the Colonel had they were fairly leftist in their politics. There was a guy named Guy Mendez mm-hmm. who works at KET now mm-hmm. as a producer. Well, Guy was the editor of the Colonel. And part of what helped us in terms of like just getting our agenda out there was Guy was very sympathetic to what we were doing, and we trusted him. So Guy was the one white guy that we would let into our meetings because we knew that he would represent us as well. But after a while, Guy had to leave the Colonel because the Colonel was taking on all these causes, you know, and he was getting some pressure.
And the Colonel is the school newspaper.
Yes. Uh-huh. So he left the Colonel and founded a paper called the Blue Tail Fly, mm-hmm. which was a little, little progressive radical newspaper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the speakers, you know, that you ask about oftentimes had to be presented at a coffee house that was right on the edge of campus called Nexus. Mm-hmm. So when there was somebody that the university would not accommodate, they would be presented there. So, you know, the radical hippie
right.
black militant types were always over there.
Okay. What about in town now? There were, I know, an NAACP chapter, a CORE chapter. I'm not sure if they were still in existence in 68 or not. But the CORE chapter actually had some faculty from the UK who
yeah.
were active. And I expect the NAACP did too, but I don't know that for sure. Maybe you do. But was there any kind of joint activity or cross-involvement there that you recall between the black students and the community groups?
You know, when I think about what we were doing here, I know we had support from the community, but it was really, I can't think of a lot of direct involvement. We found ourselves in the community a lot. I mean, on weekends that's where we would go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we would sometimes leave here on Friday and not come back till Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Did you stay in Lexington?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or we would take these road trips, you know, just hit campuses.
Oh, to other
campuses.
You know,
other campuses.
Okay.
But, you know, in terms of, there were some individuals, but I can't think of a lot of, you know, a lot of people involved from the community in what we were trying to do here. Although I think people were saying attaboy all the time, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, UK was just another world
mm-hmm.
to black folk in Lexington. So, and they were supported, but they didn't get directly involved.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of our campaign, you know.
When I talked to Ann, and I've also talked to one other Berea graduate, and both of them had about the same thing to say, which was that while there certainly were issues on that campus in terms of race, there were a few faculty or community who would help in one way or another, whether it was with money or just kind of providing a sort of an adult mentorship role of some sort. Do you recall anybody like that at UK?
Oh, yeah.
When you were coming
through? The former dean of admissions, Keller Dunn.
Keller?
Keller Dunn, yeah. Okay. I think Keller may be deceased. Mike Epstein. Adelstein. Mike Adelstein, who taught English here, who was real supportive. Anna Bowling was the one black staff person here. She was director of, the time it was the, she came directing the Y program, the YWCA, but later took a position in, I think it was the Human Relations Club they had here. She was staff person. Advising that. And there were a few other faculty people. But I tell you, somebody who was definitely a big asset to us was Dr. Oswald, John Oswald, who had come here from Berkeley. And
where was he located here?
He was the president.
He was the president? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was the president. He,
John Oswald.
Mm-hmm. He died a couple years ago. But Dr. Oswald came here definitely philosophically from another place. Like I said, he's from Berkeley, okay? So in terms
that
of like...
That explains it, right?
Yeah, you know, in terms of what we were trying to do here, He saw the rationale, you know, he knew what we were facing. Mm-hmm. So it was never unusual for him to like appear at a Black Student Union meeting, you know. And he, in his own way, opened doors for us, you know. His vice you know, I think he is there now. Gave a presentation not too long ago about kind of his reflections of that 60s period. So we had less contact with him than Dr. Oswald. But Dr. Oswald was, was fair. And somebody who we knew was supportive.
How did you meet Ann?
I met Ann in 1969. I had just come home. I think I'd been out of school maybe a month or so. And through the help of Paul Oberst over here, retired from law school, I had gotten a contact to work at the Human Rights Commission.
And Paul was one of the founding members, I think, of the State Commission.
Right. So through Paul's contact to Gayla Martin, I mean, I had a job available to me as soon as I went home. So I went home to report to my first job and met Herb Sievers, who was director of the Community Service Division. And I was to be part of that division. And I met Ann the first day on the job. And it was just a real interesting meeting because did she tell you how we met?
No, I actually didn't.
It was just,
we talked about you, but I didn't actually ask her how you met.
Right.
You
know? Well, 69 was quite a year because my father died in the summer of 69. And I wasn't sure I was going to be able to return to school. I mean, I didn't know where the money was coming from. But my uncles, my Uncle John, God bless him, pulled my uncles together and they anted up my tuition. So it allowed me to come back here and finish out, you know, because I really didn't, like I said, I didn't know where the money was coming from. So I finished school and, you know, I, through Paul Oberst, I had this job set up for me. And I went to work at the Human Rights Commission. But the first day I went to work, I was waiting in the lobby area for my interview. And heard this woman swish-swishing through the lobby area. And she'd come to say something to the receptionist. And she greeted me with, "Hello, brother." I was like, "What? How you doing?" You know, and I could tell she was right out of school because she had, she just looked fresh, you know, right out of school and had a short haircut and short skirts. So, as it turned out, my desk was right next to hers. Mm-hmm. And we were part of this community, mm-hmm. community service division. I was a community organizer, and Ann worked in the housing division. So from time to time, we would be paired up on projects. And, you know, at that time, the commission was on this heavy integration agenda. So we were, at one time, paired to go out to survey local apartments. And our job was to go in and meet with the apartment, whoever the manager was or whoever was the authority, and ask them, "How many black people do you have living here?" And they would tell us, and we would come back to the office and we'd put a pin on the map. You know, that was like proof that integration was happening in Louisville. So we did that, and, you know, we thought it was ridiculous. And we, you know, would do this stuff, but, you know, really gave us time to get to know each other. We were both fresh out of school and fresh out of the student movement. So we really kind of hooked up in terms of like the way we saw things. Mm-hmm. And we ate lunch together sometimes. And, you know, before we knew it, we were good friends. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it kind of started like that.
She's talked to me about some of the early travel that you all did.
Yeah.
And the work that you did at Plymouth Settlement House and whatnot. And actually, today, she had a copy of the book that she had mentioned to me earlier, but had loaned it to someone, I guess, and showed me a beautiful picture of both of you.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And told me I could take it. I told her I would give it to you to take back to her.
Okay.
But I did have a chance to look at it. And did your wedding really last a week?
It seemed like it. And her family knows a lot of people. I mean, they are. I've not run into too many people from Birmingham that I met in other places who didn't know their family. Mm-hmm. Her father was a just a very powerful presence in Birmingham. And they're all very gregarious people. So, you know, people know the Beards through one of the Beard children or through Reverend Beard or through their mother, who was quite well known.
Well, we didn't really talk about your wedding, but in reading it after I had left her, I saw that you were trying to incorporate African tradition mm-hmm. in Kwanzaa, and there is mention there of actually a week-long ceremony.
And the ceremony itself was a day, okay, but there were a lot of things leading up to it, and
so it wasn't every minute of every day for a week. It was
we stayed around for a week or so. And in fact, it started in Louisville. I mean, people gave us reception in Louisville. And all those people at the reception in Louisville came down to Birmingham. So, I mean, I'm still meeting people who were at my wedding, you know, because mm-hmm. it was public, it was outdoors, in the middle of the city, and it was mm-hmm. 6 p.m. So it was convenient to a lot of people. And it was, you know, there was all this talk about this African wedding, because this was 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it was a new idea, and people were just curious. Mm-hmm. You know, there were those we invited, but there were a lot of people who just came, you know, just to see what is this thing. So I guess it, you know, and exaggerate some, but it could have been a week.
Well, she didn't say that. I don't want to, I mean, the book reads, it says a week, but I don't know who did the editing and the storytelling in the book, but sounds like a pretty special event.
Oh, it really was. And the Birmingham News did a piece on it. So for us, it was, I mean, I just remember it being exciting, and the times when I just like, I mean, at your own wedding, at least for me, I was zoned out, you know. You know, there were times where people tell me this is happening at your wedding. I said, really?
Right.
You know. But I do remember that it was really powerful, because we didn't spend a lot of money, but it was big, because everybody contributed something. That's the thing I like. And it was just, you know, I mean, this was Ann Beard's wedding, so everybody wanted to go well, and everybody was in the spirit of it, even though it was a new idea, and nobody really, a lot of people didn't know how it was going to come off, because Ann was always known for, you know, having these unorthodox ideas about things. So her mother just trusted that it was going to be, she told us, in fact, just don't embarrass her, you know. So we promised her that it wouldn't be embarrassing, and we did give a lot of thought to it. So it was well planned, and it came off just beautifully, and people, you know, still talk about it. You know, it was really very special.
Well, certainly a beautiful photo of both of you.
Yeah, we have, I mean, that was done by a friend of ours. We didn't pay anything. Mm-hmm. The reception was handled by some friends of ours.
Well, that's the way to do it.
It really is. I think we didn't spend $500 on it. The most expensive thing for us were the garments. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, let me correct that. Those were given to us. Yeah, we didn't even know this guy. But the guy who designed the clothes just wanted us to wear them, and if anybody asked, to like tell them where we got the clothes. But he gave it to us.
Okay. I want to ask you some questions about Anne, and I have to tell you, I've really enjoyed working with her. I mean, she's just an incredibly creative
personality, I think.
And I wonder, and I've talked to her about this a little bit too, with her great interest in African art and culture and her music, you know, from early on, she just appears to me, with what she has done, to be what I call kind of a community teacher. Maybe not always in a formal teaching role, but an informal teaching role. And I just wonder how you would see that.
That's precisely how I see one aspect of her. You know, Anne is, I mean, one of the things that attracted me was that she's one of the most unique people I've ever met in my life. And I was intrigued by not only the personality, I mean, she's magnetic in her personality, but she's someone who has had a wealth of experience. You know, she left home at about 14, and very independent. And
somebody who really does a lot of things just based on just pure faith.
you know, I mean, home and wound up at Berea College with no money, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and promised her mother that it wasn't going to cost her, and it didn't, you know. But it's that kind of thing that really intrigued me about her as a friend, because we would do things a lot of times with really no, just kind of spontaneously, you know, no idea how we're going to get in or out of this, but let's just give it a shot, you know. So we went to Africa like that, mm-hmm. you know. And a lot of things that happened for me during that period were, I was just really, you know, trying to find out who I was, happened with her. So, you know, it was like, besides a good friendship, it was really almost like a journey to like this discovery. We were like discovering a lot about ourselves as we were working through things and being involved in programs. The Plymouth Settlement House, I mean, that in itself was like, I mean, that was a great leap in both of our development, because I knew she'd do it and she would get into it and, you know, not look back. But for me, I mean, it meant leaving a fairly secure situation at the Human Rights Commission, going to this settlement house for less money, mm-hmm. you know, but a much better job, mm-hmm. you know. So, and had I tend to be, and spontaneous, I tend to be much more rational and deliberate with my stuff. I have to like see the end before I'm willing to like embark on something. But you know, she's really tempered that side of me a lot. So I know that it's much more valuable to like try it. You know?
Well, as I've heard her describe some of the things that you together have been involved in over the year that have been kind of cultural, community cultural, the Roots and Heritage
yeah.
Festival and whatnot, and some of the things that you tried to do, the African Village
yeah.
at the Settlement House and whatnot. I wonder if to you that this kind of program that you've been involved in and actually been involved in making happen in some cases, do you see that as political organizing? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I guess it's political in a sense that well, let me tell you what I try to do. I mean, the thing that is the real agenda for me. I think it's very, what I do here is very much in tune with what Ann and I have been doing for years. But the thing that I know, and I know this from my experience as a student, and I know this just growing up during the period that I grew up, is that there are ways that people can be moved to taking control of their lives that can happen almost I don't want to say subconsciously, but I think there's a way to like impact people's consciousness about things in ways other than the direct, didactic, dogmatic approach to things, you know. I mean, there's a time for that. But I've seen people moved by being immersed in a cultural experience or, you know, being in the presence of great people or great minds, I mean, those can be life-changing experiences. I've seen them with students, you know. I saw it with myself. When Fannie Lou Hamer told us, when they asked us, what are we doing? You know, I knew she didn't mean, what are we doing in class? You know, she meant, what are you doing with your life and what you're doing for your people? And that stuck with me. I mean, that's just one of those moments where whenever, you know, I felt confused, I would think about that. And I've had a number of those kind of experiences with a number of people who, you know, I have high regard for. And it's certainly been political in my life, and it's been the kind of thing that has helped me stay clear about, you know, what my priorities are and what I think my purpose is. So, you know, I mean, this work or what we do with near day camp or what we do with any number of things, ultimately, yeah, has a political purpose. I mean, we're trying to change things, you know. And I think, you know, if education is not about that, then it's a waste of time. I don't see myself as trying to just prepare young people to go out and pursue a personal agenda or, you know, get establishing a career as such. I mean, I really think that they ought to be thinking about leadership and thinking about what they can do to serve. And I'm serious about that. And I don't think University of Kentucky really hired me to do that. But, I mean, maybe in a way, but I think I would still be here if that were not part of my agenda, that I could do those things that are spelled out in my job description, which really had nothing to do with this, you know, as I think about it. You know, we were fortunate to get in here and kind of set a direction for ourselves before I think the university knew what was happening. But it's been successful, and it's been the kind of thing where I think, you know, university has realized some positive benefits from it. But, you know, we have too. So it works.
Well, we talked a little bit about the Roots and Heritage Festival. And I understand you went to Frankfurt recently with Catherine Warner. You two were the co-chairs to receive an award from the governor.
Mm-hmm.
What was Anne's role in the festival?
She's the silent co-chair.
I can't imagine Anne being silent.
Right. Well, it's just like silent only in that she's not, her name does not appear on the roster of committee members. Mm-hmm. But Anne and Catherine have a interesting relationship because, I mean, Catherine attributes a lot of her growth to Anne. Mm-hmm. And that is so true. But Catherine is a person who has a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, and somebody who's not afraid to try something new. So with, you know, Anne's influence and Anne feeding Catherine certain ideas about what's possible and, you know, what you might consider trying, it's giving Catherine some direction in developing this festival. So, Anne is not on the roster, but everybody knows that Anne is part of this, you know. I mean, it's always been from the beginning. You know, if I'm in it, she's in it. So it's... That's kind of the way it works. It works that way with that. It works that way with the King Holiday celebration. It works that way with it's a only thing I think that we don't do, it doesn't work that way.
The NIA can.
Right. So it's like it's a collective of people who we know our roles very well, mm-hmm. and we have enough experience at these kind of things, and we know how to organize.
Right.
And we know the community pretty well.
I didn't talk to her about the Martin Luther King celebration.
Yeah.
Tell me what happens.
Well,
here
you know, it's a... that's something that has evolved over time, too, because it started here on campus, I don't know how many years ago, Betsy, but shortly after Minority of Student Affairs was founded, we started doing these observances. And there was a period where we would do small things, you know, we would have, you know, 100 people or so. We might meet over in Memorial Hall. But after a few years into it, we started collaborating with the Urban League and with what was then the Martin Luther King Jr. Scholarship Committee, which was headed up by Dr. Edgar Mack, who used to be on the School of Social Work faculty. When Dr. Parker came, William Parker, the connection with the city was a little more formalized. So we started doing it as a partnership. Now, there have been a number of people who have served in that chair, but for the last 4 or 5 years, Catherine has been the chair. Maybe that long. But with Catherine as chair, I mean, my role gets elevated a little bit, and her consultation with Anne becomes very important to, like, helping to work out, you know, kind of a vision for, like, what the observance will be like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Anne's been real helpful with that, particularly with thoughts about possible speakers, with themes, with trying to give some substance to it so that it doesn't just become another memorial service, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has to be a living kind of a tribute. And also has to inspire people to, like, continue this work.
Right.
Dr. King's work can be, you know,
okay.
You know, symbolic. It has to be something real. So that's been kind of Anne's role. You know, we all know that she's there.
Okay. I want to talk a minute, Chester, about resistance. And when I say that, I'm talking about resistance to oppression, to patriarchy, to anything. And I'm asking this because as I talk to Anne, clearly she gives me many examples of where she resisted in one way or another things that weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
The system.
Yeah.
And as I do these interviews, I'm trying to look at resistance and whether there are differences between men and women through the whole civil rights struggle, but even outside the specific civil rights movement. And I'm wondering if you, one, will kind of define resistance for me the way you see it, and then talk to me a little bit about how you see Anne resisting.
Hmm. Well, I guess for me, resistance has always been, you know, the act of just defying what the society has prescribed for us, you know, which is historically it's been a status of inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I came to understand that, I mean, I thank God I was a student in the 60s, because I came to understand that when I got here and really encountered a very oppressive situation, you know, in a situation not just designed to, like, keep us on the edge. I mean, we were clear about the fact that there was simply no preparation for our presence here. Mm-hmm. And the students who, even the black students who we encountered when we first came, had not come to grips with that whole question of resistance. Really had not. They were inclined to get by getting along. So the major conflict that we had, and it came to surface around, conflicts around the direction of this Orgina group as opposed to the Black Student Union. But, you know, their attitude was that if we just assimilate and we just get along and kind of stay out of the way, then things will get better eventually. And we just thought that was a foolish position. That, you know, if the issues weren't on the table and we weren't willing to, like, take some gambles with bringing some change, and we're talking about just basic things, like, don't call us nigger when we walk down the street tonight. Okay, if you could just cool that out some. Or don't play Dixie at the football games, you know? Mm-hmm. Where's the school song? You know, we just thought that was fundamental, and that we really couldn't tolerate it, you know, and we just wondered about those people who could. So, you know, for me, is that fundamental, and that's been something that kind of stuck with me. And, you know, I mean, after you get a little older and, you know, have family and career and all that as part of what you have to consider, then, you know, your approach is a little different. But, I mean, the act of, like, resisting and knowing that, I mean, you know, if you're committed to your principles and knowing that ultimately that you prevail. I mean, I really believe that ultimately you prevail. Because we've seen it. I mean, in my lifetime, we've seen it. That, you know, it validates one as a resistor or one as an
activist or as somebody who's doing work for change.
It just does not happen without that. I mean, I just don't think that people do the right thing for the right reason. They do the right thing because either there's something at stake or the alternative is worse. But there first has to be some sort of engagement, some kind of struggle.
Do you think there are any gender differences to resistance?
Well, you know, I guess in terms of the way Ann and I approach things, there are things that Ann can do that I don't think I can do. You know, I think the risks are different for black men. And she knows that, you know? I mean, it's like, I mean, there have been occasions where, say, if we're stopped by a cop, Ann can, like, say things to a cop that I know I can't say. You know, I mean, she can confront cops, and it'll be an entirely different outcome. If I confront a cop saying what she'll say, then the outcome will be very different, you know. So, I mean, I think it certainly differs along that lines. That's just a lot of history to that.
Right.
I mean, tactically, I think there's some differences. I'm just talking personally, in the way she and I approach things on occasion. And a lot of those are driven by the fact that she's a woman and I'm a man. But, we're very much in tune with where we see, you know, what the object is, what the objective is. But
would you describe Anne as a leader?
Oh, definitely. Oh, yes. I think she's recognized as a leader by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I would too. But how do you see her leading? What's her style?
She leads very much by example. Anne is a person who is very consistent. And I think anybody who knows her and have known her over, say, last 20 years, won't see many contradictions in terms of what she says and what she does. And the one thing that she probably, as a leader, the one thing that I think she's coming to better recognize is that everybody won't do it the way she does it, because she's a person who, is very fearless in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And there are people who simply can't put it on the line like she does. But I think in terms of example of courage and conviction and principle, you know, I know a lot of people who tell me that they admire her and that she's had a great impact on the way they think or the way they conduct their lives. Even though they, you know, probably wouldn't do it the way she does it.
Mm-hmm.
But, she's very much a leader.
Do you think Anne could be described as a feminist?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think my daughters are feminists, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they are very clear about who they are as women. And at the same time, they make some real distinctions between certain feminist issues and their own philosophical positions on things, certain classic feminist issues. And I say this in that they never confuse their roles as feminists and their roles as black women. I mean, I'm not sure if that's clear to you, but I'm saying that race and gender are two issues that they don't confuse. You know, they don't confuse the fact that certain things happen to them, or certain things are issues in their lives because they're black women.
Well, she and I talked a little bit about the early women's movement. I did not ask her if she thought of herself as a feminist at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I also understand sort of the history
mm-hmm.
of what you're saying, and we did talk about that a little bit. I don't know, would Anne describe herself? Would she call herself a feminist?
She may shy away from the term.
Yeah.
But I think.
But the principles.
The principles. Yeah, I think she endorses most. Yeah, because I mean she's a person who is very sensitive to oppression by any category.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. One last question, Chester. Has Anne shared anything with you about the interviews that we've been doing?
No, not a thing. No.
Okay. We talked a little bit this morning about me as a white woman doing an interview with her. And mm-hmm. I raised the question. She said, oh, I didn't think you'd ask me that.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And how that's kind of difficult. Because mm-hmm. there's just no way that I can completely understand her or her me,
mm-hmm.
you know, as it goes. And I just wondered if she had talked to you about that at all along the way.
Her comment, when I asked her how the interview go, she says, these are good interviews. And, I mean, I'll tell you that she says you're a good interviewer because you, well, she's done a lot of interviews, you know, a lot of interviews. And I think when she's allowed to, like, talk, you know, and apparently what the way you structure things has allowed her to, like, talk and develop lines of thinking. So she's been pleased with the interviews themselves.
Good. Well, I have, too. It's, I think, been a good series that we've done together.
Yeah, so, and she's a...
I did say to her this morning, one of the problems I have as an interviewer, though, is that I frequently want to talk to her. I want to have a conversation with her, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't do that in this role.
Mm-hmm.
In the taping, we do it a little bit afterwards, you know,
right.
But...
I wish you could have met her mother. I mean, in terms of personality, a universe away. I mean, her mother was like a...
Very different?
Very different. Very... A gentle, kind... Not a quiet woman, but a quiet spirit, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I would be around him, and I was like, how do you have her? But in terms of their, mm-hmm. where they come from,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a deep level, these are like really two special women. And her mother was just a wonderful person.
You didn't know her father?
Not, if you, yeah.
You did know her father?
Yeah, but I never met him.
Oh, okay.
Her father was such a, like I said, such a powerful presence in Birmingham that you can hear people, I mean, I've been in her house, and you can hear people talk about him and share stories, and you would think he's in the next room.
Hmm.
And this is like 36 years after his death.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a man who I tell her sometimes, if Christians were like your father, I might be inclined to be a Christian, you know, because he was a real servant of a man. I mean, he's a brilliant man, but was very clear about his role in serving people, and would. Now, I mean, you see the impact of his work in Birmingham because, like I said, you can ask anybody about him and they'll know something about him. But we had, I don't know if she told you this, but we were, we were preparing for the wedding. Did she tell you this story?
No, we didn't talk about the wedding.
Okay, but I really got insight into like this man's influence. We were preparing for the wedding, and the day before the wedding, we went down to the park to kind of clean up a bit. So we get there, it's me, Anne, and her brothers. And there's this gazebo in the middle of the park. And the gazebo is like a flop house for these winos, right? And these homeless people. So we get there, and you know, it's early morning. These guys are like still there, just starting to move around, right? So we start picking up paper. We didn't want to disturb them. We're picking up paper and trash. And one of the guys said, "What's going on?" So we said, "Well, we're getting ready for a wedding tomorrow." So they said, "Who's getting married?" So we said, "Ann Beard, Reverend Beard's daughter." I said, "Reverend Beard's daughter?" And all these guys got up and started pitching in, picking up trash, bottles and everything. You know, I said, "That's my man, Reverend Beard." You know, so it's like, and I mean, you'll get that element. Then you'll get, you know, I mean, the la-di-da of Birmingham will say, you know, feel the same kind of, you know, warmth of this man. It's just really something.
If she was different from her mother, do you think she was more like her father?
Personality probably more like her father. I get the impression that he was pretty direct, and she'd idolize her father, you know. And it was her father who, I think, recognized that she was, of all his children, I think he saw her as probably the most gifted. And would engage her in these conversations. I mean, their dinner, you know, mealtime talk was about the affairs of the world, and you know, he was, you know, an intellectual type guy. So Anne was engaged in adult conversation early, and used to eavesdrop a lot when the adults would talk. And a lot of interesting people came to her house, you know. I mean, there were movement people, and there were people from the church community, and you know, the who's who of Birmingham. So she knew Ralph Bunch and people like that. So it, you know, her development was kind of unusual.
And it sounds like the two of you together have really continued that kind of cultural environment here with people that have come through.
Yeah. I mean, that's been why I stay here, because it does offer that opportunity. Plus, it's like breaking new ground. Couldn't do this in New York City. You know what I mean?
That's right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Betsy.
Is there anything else you want to say before I...
No, I enjoy the interview.
Okay. Turn it off?